You are listening to the Israel Connection on JE Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Hannah Brown is a journalist who covers culture and has been the movie critic for the Jerusalem Post since 2001. Born and raised in New York City, she was a movie critic at the New York Post, as well as a columnist and an editor in the business section there. After a short post-mortem on Israel's showing at Eurovision, we take a look at what's on offer today in the way of Israeli movies and TV series from streaming services available on the internet. I'm going to welcome Hannah Brown back to the Israel Connection. You've been a guest on my show before. You have been a film critic on the Jerusalem Post, but I think you branched out a little bit in later years, in more recent years, into general culture in terms of what you like to cover in the media.
First, I started out writing about mostly movies. Then as television got more interesting and just more varied, I started writing about television. And then in the last, say, 4 years, I've also started to write a bit more about culture, about museums and music and Jewish celebrities and that kind of thing.
But you still pursue TV series and film. That's still an area that you do come back to every now and again.
That's my main focus. That's always going to be my main focus, because I would be watching everything, going to movies, watching TV shows anyway. So this way I can just make it part of my job. So I'll always do that.
One of the most recent things you've done was to do with Eurovision. Because so that's what I saw that you had written about. Now, perhaps we can do a little post-mortem on what you thought about Eurovision.
Noah Kirel did better than most people predicted. I mean, obviously, she has her diehard fans who, hoped she would come in first place, but she wasn't doing very well in the polls going into Eurovision. You know, between the time that the videos were released and then the time the competition took place, the top that she reached was seventh. So, it really was good news for her, the third place finished, because mostly people do come in around where they're predicted to come in. She's, very young. She's 22. So obviously she's got this great career ahead of her. I think that she performed very well. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen her be better than she was. And that's what you really hope for, that they'll give a kind of personal best performance in that high pressure situation. So yeah, I think she did really well. The Sweden was predicted to win, and Sweden won. So that wasn't a surprise, but she was the surprise, I thought.
Yeah, I think it was a very inspiring performance when I saw it. I never really held much stock with the song itself. But I don't hold much stock with most of the songs that you hear.
No, I don't like most of the songs either on Eurovision. I certainly thought she was better than the song from Australia, but that wasn't considered a contender this year. But look, it's been a long time since the ABBA and groups like that, where you could hear the instruments playing, were in Eurovision, where they had a live orchestra on stage. Things were just very different. Now it's all recorded, pre-recorded playback music. And most of the songs are also in English, although this year there were some songs that were in the home country's language that did pretty well. I would always be happy to hear the Israeli contestants singing in Hebrew. I think that would be really great, but they haven't done that in a long, long time.
Anyway, well, let's move on to look at what are the offerings in the way of Israeli film and television series for those people that would like very much to plonk themselves in front of a screen somewhere and digest what Israel has to offer in the area of cinema and film. And I'm going back maybe 2, 3, 4 years, because some of the offerings we're going to discuss are out there currently. I'm going to shoot through the films that one can watch firstly on Netflix, which seems to be the streaming outlet where you get the largest offering of films from Israel. Is this the way you see it as well? That's where most of it seems to be happening, where most of the action is. If you want to, yeah, of course, you can always go to a specialized streaming service like Izzy if you want Israeli films, just Israeli films. But I'm talking about the general streaming networks.
Yeah, I think that Netflix is just so giant. It's just, I think it's much bigger than most of the other streaming services. So what they have from every single country is a larger number of offerings. So yeah, so it makes sense that in Australia would have the most Israeli movies. And I think it does in the US too. Although, I mean, I don't know what you can get on Amazon Prime in Australia. But in America, I know I'm from America. I have a lot of friends there, and they can get an awful lot of Israeli movies on Amazon Prime now, and some of the series. So that's another good option if you like Israeli films and television.
Right. Okay. Well, the first one I want to mention is Tel Aviv on Fire, which is a 2018 internationally co-produced comedy drama satire film, directed by a Palestinian Israeli film writer, Sameh Zawabi. If we're going to go through a whole lot of films, I probably don't have time to give people the plot in any great detail. But this film was a success. It premiered at the Haifa International Film Festival, and where it won the Best Film and Best Screenplay awards. It has had some success. And it's interesting that it has an Arab Israeli, perhaps, as the film writer. And, you know, I believe you liked this particular production.
Yeah, I thought it was a very funny film. And it's just in one sentence, it's about a Palestinian who ends up collaborating on a soap opera as a soap opera writer with an Israeli soldier whose wife is a big fan of the soap opera, and it's a soap opera that's done in Ramallah. Now, you know, it's maybe not the most realistic movie in the world, because right now I don't think that they're doing any soap operas in the West Bank, but apparently at one time they did, and many Israelis have been fans of Egyptian movies, of movies in Arabic that are shown here on Friday, or they used to be a long time ago. They used to be shown on Friday afternoons on television just before Shabbat. And so a lot of Israelis know Arabic. Eventually they got subtitles, but a lot of people used to watch them, Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews, and they were very, very popular. So I think that, and they're very, tend to be very melodramatic and exaggerated. And so Tel Aviv on Fire is about a guy who ends up writing on a series that's very much in the mold of these Egyptian movies, and where very, very exaggerated portrayals of everyone, including the Israeli characters. So anyway, I thought it was a nice movie, and it was a different perspective than I've seen before.
Okay. Well, I haven't quite seen that yet. So that's on my list now after what we've been discussing. Now, the next one is perhaps the giant of them all, and I'm talking about Fauda. This is the Israeli television series developed by Lior Raz and Avi Issacharoff, drawing on their experiences in the Israeli Defense Forces. Now, we're going back to February 2015 for when the series first premiered. It tells the story of Doron, the commander in the Mister Aravim unit, and his team. In the first season, they pursue a Hamas arch-terrorist known as the Panther. Now, the first season was filmed in Kafr Qassim during the 2014 Israeli-Gaza conflict. It premiered, as I said, in February 2015. Then we've had the second season, which premiered in December 2017. The third season took place in Gaza Strip and was aired in 2019 and 2020. The fourth season arrived at the beginning of this year. And in season four of Fauda, apparently Israeli tactics come under fire, and so do the show's heroes. What can we say about Fauda? Of course, that's what most people watch if they're going to watch anything Israeli in the media.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think Netflix has made Fauda so famous around the world, and it's been a really big hit in almost every country where it's been shown on Netflix. And that's a lot of countries, including in places like Lebanon, where it was in the every new season has been in the top 10 when it premiered, which is really interesting because obviously, you know, Lebanon's still in a state of war with Israel, but and yet a great many Lebanese Netflix viewers chose to watch it. So it's very interesting. And I've definitely heard that, you know, there are some Palestinians who here have criticized it because it's from the Israeli point of view primarily, but they watch it. They watch it. And it's kind of like a guilty pleasure for some people on the West Bank as well. But I think one of the reasons that it works is because in the past, before Fauda, pretty much every depiction of Israeli forces just had Palestinians as they were only terrorists. And you didn't really see that there was anything else going on in the West Bank or Gaza. And here you see there were many, many characters who are Arab and are played by Arab actors. And so you see their whole stories and you see their whole families and you get, you know, you may not agree with their perspective, but I think it was a very interesting show for a lot of people here to see because it does give a look at what life on the West Bank is like and then later in Gaza. And then in the fourth season, which is set, quite a bit of it is set in Europe. And so then you also see the lives of European Muslims. And so I think that that's part of the reason it's such a success, because it's just it's interesting to see the two conflicting sides in a lot of detail. Avi Issacharoff and Lior Raz were both involved in this counterterrorism as part of their military service, and they know firsthand the world that they're writing about. I just think it has a certain realism. You know, I'm not really in a position to evaluate exactly how realistic all of it is, but I think it gives a certain feeling of realism that has really been lacking in the past. You know, you had movies like Operation Thunderbolt from 1977 that was directed by Menachem Golan about the Entebbe rescue. And it's an exciting movie and people love that movie. And I'm not putting down that movie in any way, but something like Fauda it's much more nuanced. It goes into much more detail. They really went for realism in Fauda much more than had been done in the past. The acting is good. Lior Raz stars in it. There's a cast of really the best actors in Israel, both Arabs and Jews. There's also some actors from Europe came and appeared in it as well. It's just a very tense drama, suspenseful. I mean, Stephen King, you know, the best-selling author, he said that it's all killer, no filler. And now he's not Jewish. He's not known for being particularly interested in the Middle East. I've never heard him talk about the Middle East before. He just likes the show because it's suspenseful. So I think that they made a great entertainment product. And then that's really gone all around the world.
And it looks like it's going to keep on keeping on because season 5, although it hasn't been officially announced yet, is definitely on the cards.
Right. They're going to go with it. There's definitely going to be a season 5, but we don't know when. And I think it'll be interesting to see what it focuses on, because the first two seasons really focused on Israel and the West Bank. The third season moved into Gaza and the fourth season Europe. So we'll just have to see where they go with it now. Maybe America, because where else can you go? I don't know. Or Australia, perhaps. I don't know.
I think hardly for this type of a show. Coming on to the next film that one can catch on Netflix is Hit and Run. Now, this film is actually from the creators of Fauda and is an international thriller that follows a murder investigation from Tel Aviv to New York City. And we're speaking about Lior Raz, and he's one of the actors in this film. This film apparently starts off with a lot of twists that keep the interest of the viewer, but then I think it kind of peters out towards the end that loses a bit of steam. Have you seen this film?
Yeah, it's a series. Yeah, I saw it. Yeah, I thought exactly as you did that in the first couple of episodes. I was really on the edge of my seat, and then I felt when it completely moved to America, it became less interesting as it went on. It didn't maintain the level of suspense, and it was an enormously expensive production. I think that it was maybe not by Netflix standards, but by Israeli standards. I mean, no one had ever heard of anything like this. I think they said the budget was like $80 million or something like that, which by Israel, again, you know, in a typical Israeli movie that will be made for maybe $500,000, maybe less. So this is a lot of money. They announced that it would only be one season. They never announced a second season. And it ends on a cliffhanger. So it's really a letdown in a way if you stick with it to the end and then there's no second season. Well, you probably want to talk next or soon about Ghosts of Beirut, because that's the series that Lior Raz and Avi Issacharov did next. And it's just come out.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute, because we're still pushing through what Netflix has to offer. But we'll go through quickly some of the other offerings. We've got Rough Diamonds, which I think you think is pretty good, but it's not very Israeli, you would say.
Well, there are some of the creators are Israeli. A couple of the cast, I think, are from Israel or have lived in Israel, but it's really set in Antwerp. It's in Belgium, so it's not. It's about an ultra-Orthodox family with a son who went to London, and then he comes back for the funeral of one of his brothers. I mean, it happens right at the beginning. That's not a spoiler. He comes back to Belgium, and he's become totally secular. He's upset about his brother's death, and he wants to look further into it. And it's a story about an ultra-Orthodox family, but it's not, the connection to Israel is not that strong. I think that there's some Israeli companies that may have invested in it, but from the viewer's point of view, it's not really an Israeli series.
And you would perhaps have similar comments about another series, Black Space, which you say, even though it's set in Israel, it could take place anywhere. It's about an ordinary morning at a small town high school that turns into a nightmare when anonymous figures in masks have committed a massacre, leaving four dead students. This kind of scenario sounds typical of what happens in America almost every day.
Right. Unfortunately, yeah. Fortunately, it doesn't sound too familiar in Israel. We haven't had those kinds of crimes here yet. And, you know, I hope we never will. It's well done. Guri Alfi is very good in the lead. And there's a young actress called, her name is Susanna Papadian. And she's like Armenian Israeli. And she's awfully good in one of the supporting roles. And I think she's going to be a big star. She has a starring part coming out in a new movie that'll come out probably next year called The Monkey House. So, and like I say, it is very well done. And yet, you know, the reaction to it in Israel was just like, well, that just can't happen here. Can it? I don't, you know, I couldn't say for sure, but it just seems very improbable that this kind of thing could go on with nobody, with none of the security guards. I mean, there's quite good security in every school that I've ever visited here. In Israel, people are not going to stand around outside the classroom wondering what to do. They're just not. I mean, so the security guards are not going to do that. Like that happened in that, you know, tragic school shooting in Uvalde in Texas in America. So it's just hard for people to see that as a realistic portrayal of life here. Although I do think that it's well written, it's well acted, but it just wasn't very convincing to me.
Okay. Now we'll just skip through a couple of others quickly, because I want to get on to a couple of films that are not on Netflix that are significant. We've got Never Stop Dreaming, which is the Shimon Peres documentary, and that can definitely be recommended to view the life of a man who was greater than life in terms of what he achieved. Of course, he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, served as Israeli Prime Minister twice, and negotiated the 1994 Israel-Jordan Peace Treaty. So anybody who wants to catch a big slice of Israeli history, this is a good documentary, I guess.
It's a very good, it's entertaining. You know, I think it would be great to show in schools because it teaches people a lot of history. It could teach students a lot of history very quickly because it's vivid. And then Paris gave one of his last interviews. So he was interviewed when he was in his 90s and he was interviewed for it. So I think it's, I really recommend it. I interviewed the director and yeah, I really think it's a good, it's a very good movie.
So your interview with the directors out there somewhere for people to catch?
Yes, yeah, you can. It's online for sure. But I mean, the main thing is they should just see the series.
Yes,
the film rather.
Yes, the film. Yes.
You are currently listening to an extensive interview with Hannah Brown, the movie critic from the Jerusalem Post, talking about what's on offer today in the way of Israeli movies and TV series from streaming services on the internet.
Now, the last one that I'm going to talk about on Netflix is The Beauty Queen of Jerusalem. Now, this is about a family living through the Ottoman Empire, the British Mandate, and Israel's War of Independence, a long period of history. It's a multi-generational historical melodrama which was shot in Hebrew, English, Ladino, and Arabic. It won Best Daily Drama in 2021 by the Israeli Television Academy. Unfortunately, I couldn't quite digest it. I think some of its coverage of history was a bit scant. And I must say that what really bothered me was the scenes of towns and villages that they showed within the film that were so obviously models, and the explosions that went off every now and again had no oomph at all. It was like firecrackers. I don't think it was very successful either. What's your take on Beauty Queen of Jerusalem, based on a book?
Well, yeah, I pretty much agree with you completely. And we really have the same taste, I think, in a lot of things, because I just did not get into the series. I don't know. I just didn't think that it was really credible. I don't know that it really got my interest and held it. You know, a lot of characters are introduced and it's got also thousands of episodes. It runs 5 days a week. It's really like a soap opera. And that's not how I usually like to watch television. I'll see one episode a week, or maybe over a few days, I'll watch every episode of a series. But every day, it's a big, big commitment. Michael Aloni is in it. He's the star of Schlissel. He has very loyal fans around the world. So I think it's best for people who just like to see Michael Aloni. For a historical drama, I agree with you. It's a bit thin, and that can be frustrating.
Mm, absolutely. Now, on Apple TV Plus, we've got Valley of Tears, which is about the Yom Kippur War, when the Middle East was shaken by a very serious encounter between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Now, this is a 10-episode Israeli series. What do you feel about this particular series?
Well, I was very impressed with it. I thought it was great, and it concentrates on one particular battle where the Israelis were badly outnumbered, and it shows that in the beginning there was, you know, a bit of chaos of the intelligence hadn't really been conveyed that this attack was about to happen. They didn't have enough troops in place. And that's why the war went so badly for Israel in the beginning. And that's why there was a commission of inquiry for Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan after the war. And it's still a controversial subject in Israel because it's a war that had so many Israeli casualties. So it's something that people are very passionate about here. And interestingly, when the series was shown in Israel, it provoked a lot of discussion. It was really the first time that many veterans of that war talked about their experiences, not just in terms of a news report, but talked about emotionally what it was like for them. There were quite a few who had post-traumatic stress disorder. In the 70s, it was very taboo for men to discuss that. Now it isn't. And it really, it provoked, it inspired these Facebook groups with hundreds, thousands of veterans talking about their experiences. And there were interviews after the show on television. It was this very cathartic moment for a lot of people who had served in that war and their families who had never really talked about it with them before. That was a really amazing thing to see happening because of a television series. And I think that also, like what I said about the Shimon Peres documentary, that it's a lot of history in a very entertaining and suspenseful form. So I think that it's really a great way to find out more about the history of Israel during that period. But I also want to say that it's a tough series. Obviously, it's about a war, clearly, but it doesn't spare you. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of violence, a lot of death. So people should be prepared for seeing that before they tune into that series.
Yeah, the story is told from the very personal perspectives of four different sets of participants. And I've seen a comment that says it almost feels like one of those war miniseries throwbacks, like The Winds of War, considering that we're shown multiple stories on multiple fronts.
Yeah, I think it is a little bit like that. And I think there's a young intelligent soldier whose warnings weren't listened to, and he's right in the thick of it. And there are other soldiers who are fighting the battle from different angles. And then there's a father who's trying to find his son, female soldier who's trying to find her lover. And so, yeah, it sort of goes from different directions. And I think it was really well done. It has some of the best actors in Israel. Joy Rieger, Aviva Lush, many, Lior Ashkenazi is in it. He plays the father who's looking for his son, and Meor Schweitzer, and so many people who were really terrific. Yeah, I think it's really one of the best. I was surprised that it was picked up by Apple TV, because I wasn't sure if there would be interest in it outside of Israel, but apparently there is. So I was happy to hear that.
Yeah, the other big series that was on Apple TV was Tehran. And I had the great pleasure of interviewing the director of that film just after it came out.
Yeah, Tehran is also very suspenseful. It's about a Mossad agent, and it's Israeli actors and then some young Iranian actors who live abroad. I thought that was a very suspenseful show. And it's also, it has the protagonist is a woman. It's a female Mossad agent who's an Israeli from an Iranian family. And so she's grown up speaking Farsi. And so she's well suited to go in, and they're trying to disable the nuclear program. And it seems like whenever they show an episode, something parallel in the news in Iran would happen in real life. You know, people were joking about that it seemed like it was predicting the future.
Yeah, those people who are hearing us at the moment thinking that these films are not accessible because they're on all these streaming services that you've got to pay to subscribe. With most of these services, I think you can get a free trial. So if you're desperate to watch a film, you can take out a free trial and watch anything, I think, that we've been discussing today. And which includes the last film that I want to deal with, which is Ghosts of Beirut. I decided last night to take out a trial subscription to Showtime, which is where this film is available. It's only a four-part spy drama based on one of the greatest espionage stories of modern times, the manhunt for Imad Mughniyeh, the elusive Lebanese terrorist who outwitted his adversaries in the CIA and the Mossad for over two decades. So you're also a rep for this film.
Yeah, it's a series. It's a four-part series. I guess if they put them all together, it would be like a four-hour movie, but it's different episodes. Yeah, I mean, it's from the creators of Fauda. And I think it's also very well done, and it's really interesting. But I didn't feel that it worked quite as well as Fauda, because I felt that some of the characters... I don't know if you felt this way, but some of the characters of the CIA agents who are hunting for Imad it's in basically two time frames. It's in the 1980s in Beirut during the war, and then later in like the early 2006, 2007. I felt that some of they try to make these CIA agents into full-fledged characters, but they're really not so interesting. I mean, you're really more interested in getting back to the to the hunt for the terrorist than into their personal lives. So for me, that was a little bit lacking in that way. If you read the news, you know what happened to this terrorist who he was accused of the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983, also of the U.S. Embassy in 1983, and, you know, many, many other horrible, horrible crimes. The bombing of the, was it the Jewish center in Buenos Aires? And he was responsible or is believed to have been responsible for so many different horrible attacks. If you don't remember what happened in the end to him, I'm not going to say it. But if you know, so you kind of know where it's heading a little bit. But I did feel that the actors are very strong, the Israeli actors who are in it. Amir Hori, who plays Imad as a young man in Beirut in the 80s. And then Hisham Suleiman, who plays him when he's a bit older, but he's still very dangerous. And I thought they gave incredible performances. So it definitely was interesting. I just felt it didn't quite keep me as engrossed as Fauda. Part of it was just knowing the ending.
Yes. I've only watched the first episode. I think I'm definitely going to watch the last three. It's not too much to catch at all. And it's quite an interesting, innovative narrative approach that's augmented by some deep journalistic research and documentary elements. And what I found in the first episode was the attitudes that the CIA and the Mossad have towards each other. Quite a lot of contempt was being expressed from one side for the other.
Yeah, there's a lack of understanding. It's true, that is an interesting aspect to it that I didn't mention. It seemed that the way they portrayed it, that the Israelis were more realistic and the Americans were more idealistic.
Yeah, this guy, Mugnier, was quite a figure. He was a founding member of Lebanon's Islamic Jihad organization and number two in Hezbollah's leadership. Information about him is scant, but he's believed to have been Hezbollah's chief of staff and understood to have overseen Hezbollah's military, intelligence, and security apparatuses. He was one of the main founders of Hezbollah in the 1980s. He's been described as a brilliant military tactician and very elusive, and often referred to as an untraceable ghost, which is where we get the title of the series. I'm definitely going to hang in here, and I think from the first episode I've seen, it's very good. The production values are excellent, and the acting and the locations are very believable. Even it's shot in Morocco, I believe.
Yeah, no, it's definitely very, very well done, and I thought the acting was really strong.
We've covered quite a lot of productions in our interview today. Can you perhaps preempt anything else that's on the horizon that we don't know about yet?
One of the movies, when we were setting this up, one of the movies that I recommended that you see, which is on Netflix in America, and it's also on Netflix in Israel, but apparently it hasn't gotten to you yet, is this movie, Image of Victory, which is a movie about the independence war in Israel. It's really, really good. And it's better if you can see it in a theater, which I know isn't always possible. If there's a Jewish film festival, you should look for it, though. The battle scenes are really very well done. One thing that's interesting is that the two wars in Israel that have not been portrayed in drama very much in movies are the Independence War and the Yom Kippur War. And now we had Valley of Tears for the Yom Kippur War, and then Image of Victory about the Independence War. It's about a Kibbutz Nitzanim and the battle for Kibbutz Nitzanim, where also another story of Israelis being very, very badly outnumbered, in this case by Egyptian troops. It's also told from the point of view of an Egyptian photojournalist who was embedded with the frontline troops. And it's really one of the best movies I've ever seen. So you've got to see it. See it when you can. Image of Victory. Well, put that one down.
I hope you'll come here in some shape or form. We should mention that it's actually made by an Israeli director who's of some note, Avi Nesher.
Yeah, he's terrific. He made his first movie when he was 24 in 1978, and he's still doing these great movies now. Very few directors who've managed to stay at their top of their game for so many decades. Next year, I got a sneak peek at a new movie that he's done that's coming out in Europe in a few months called The Monkey House. It's a kind of a literary mystery, and it's very different. But he just keeps doing wonderful work, and I think people should look for his name.
Have you interviewed him in your career?
Quite a few times, yeah. He's very happy to talk about his movie. So he spent several years when he was growing up in New York, so his English is excellent.
He had a sad incident in his life. Didn't his son get killed in a car accident?
Yeah, his son was killed in a car and bike accident in 2018. It was a terrible tragedy. Part of his way of coping was to keep working. He was able to make Image of Victory. It was filmed during really the height of COVID, and he somehow got it made. And actually, interestingly, his daughter is, she's about 26 or 27, and she is now about to start shooting her first film. So it's kind of all in the family.
Great stuff. Now, just before we go, I want to say that I may be disappointing some listeners who may have hoped that we would have talked about the film Tantura and the Jordanian film Faha. But I think that we're going to leave that aside because I think too much publicity has gone towards Faha, which has seen it get a very good rating on IMDb, the international movie database that I look at to decide whether something's worth watching or not. It's one of my main criterion that I follow. I think that the film Tantura caused a bit of a stir, but Benny Morris tore it to shreds. So I think if I was to talk to Alan Schwartz and try and mention any of the stuff that Benny Morris said, the interview would be ended abruptly. So anyway, we're not going to talk about these two films.
No, I mean, you could give him a try. Alan Schwartz is always happy to do an interview.
I have tried because I like to dabble in areas that the anti-Israel brigade are trumpeting at any particular time and try to shoot down some of the narratives that they're putting out there, which sometimes don't hold much water.
Well, Alon Schwartz is not anti-Israel. I mean, he's a patriotic Israeli. I think you would probably disagree with most of what he has to say on the issues, but he's not anti-Israel.
Okay. I really appreciate you giving us your time today, Hannah, and with your knowledge and experience of what goes on in Israeli film and cinema. I think we've given people a good idea of what's worth watching.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that as all these Israeli series and films are getting good ratings on services like Netflix and Apple TV Plus, I think you're only going to see more of them coming up.
There must be things showing in Israel which would be earmarked to go overseas.
So many things. There was just a series called A Body That Works. It won a couple of prizes in Series Mania, which is a competition in France that it's a very prestigious competition in the television industry. It's about a couple in Tel Aviv who can't have a baby on their own, so they get a surrogate mother to carry their child. It becomes very complicated, but it's really good. And it stars Yehuda Levy, who's one of the biggest stars in Israel. Rotem Sela, also, she's very, very popular here. And Lior Raz is in it also. He plays a novelist. He's kind of like a bad boy novelist, kind of hell-raising type of guy, but a guy who sits at a desk. So that's kind of new for him. There's another one. It's called The Malevolent Bride. It's running now, or maybe the last episode just ran, but it's just been on Israeli television. And that's like a horror series set in the ultra-Orthodox community. It's like The Exorcist, but in Mea Shearim. It's pretty scary, actually. I liked it. And then there's going to be a series coming up, like in about a week, I have to check, 5 days, that's based on the story of Moshe Katsav. He was the former president. He was accused of rape and he went to prison. And so it's basically his story. That's going to be very controversial here. It's always hard for me to gauge what people are going to like outside of Israel. Here people it's going to provoke a lot of debate here. So there's a lot coming out.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to hear about that as well. So we've done a couple lot of territory. We've been titillating our audience without doubt, who may take some of our advice and go and watch what we've been recommending. I really appreciate it once again, and it's great chatting with you.
Yeah, good to talk to you, David. Be well.
Professor Robbie Sabol is a professor of international law at the Faculty of Law, Hebrew University, Jerusalem, and a visiting professor at Tel Aviv University. He is a member of the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague. He spoke at a webinar organized by UK Lawyers for Israel last weekend on the topic International Law Tailor-Made for Israel, where he explained how Israel often seems to be treated differently to other states under international law.
Which brings me to the subject of the Arab attempts to brand Israel's activities as illegitimate. And for doing this, they've warped, in my opinion, international law, and hence try to make tailor-made rules that are applicable only to Israel. And I've made a list of some of them, not in any particular order, of where I think international law has been invented only for Israel. And again, not in any particular order. First is, somehow UN resolutions create international law. This is not true. No state in the world is on record as accepting UN General Assembly resolutions as binding, except as regards Israel. And most probably our listeners have heard, Israel is violating UN resolutions. Rubbish. They're political statements. But they don't create international law. And the drafters of the UN Charter very carefully refrain from giving any UN body the right to create international law. International law is created by states, not by the UN. Nevertheless, we still hear, Israel has violated UN resolutions. Again, only as regards Israel. The second point is, when you sign an armistice agreement, you reach what is called an armistice demarcation line. It marks the line from beyond which your troops shouldn't move. And Israel signed in 1949 armistice agreements with all our Arab neighbors, which included armistice demarcation lines. And particularly in the Egyptians, but in the others as well, there's a clause inserted by the Arab states saying, these are not boundaries. These are not permanent boundaries. But somehow the green line between Israel and Jordan, that is the line that demarcated what is the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, somehow under international law become a boundary. Now, if Israel negotiates that, it could do. But to say that what was an armistice line has for Israel suddenly automatically become a political boundary is rubbish. But again, all states, including friendly states, including the United Kingdom, say, yes, the old 1949 green line. It was called green because it was marked with a green crayon on the map. That somehow is the permanent boundary. Why? Jordan, when he signed, he said, this is not a boundary. Somehow, for Israel, an armistice demarcation line is a boundary. This is true only for Israel. What else? Military occupation. It's not a pleasant, but it's a part of the laws of war, which you do when you occupy enemy territory. And somehow for Israel, the word occupation is always associated with illegal. Why? Because it's Israel. Because under laws of war, occupation is legal. The US occupation, let's say, of Japan after the Second World War was perfectly legal. The Allied occupation of Germany after the Second World War was perfectly legal. The US occupation of Iraq after the Gulf War was perfectly legal. By the way, it's interesting, the UN Security Council, which is not the most friendly of bodies towards Israel, has never called it illegal occupation. Why? Because the powers themselves know that under laws of war, occupation is legal. It's not something pleasant, it's not something permanent, and Israel doesn't want it to be permanent. But for Israel, you must have seen this, the illegal occupation. Again, gaining a point which they're not entitled to. Something that I find very nefarious is the beginning of the use of the word apartheid. The moment you're smeared with the word apartheid, it's untouchable, taboo, it's illegal. And our Arab opponents are perfectly aware of this. And they've done it in two ways. When we built a security fence separating Israel from Judea and Samaria, this somehow became an apartheid wall. Why? It separated Israel's sovereign territory from territories in dispute. And to pass it, you had to go, you're going through border control. Fences are not nice, but sometimes good fences make good neighbors. But for Israel, this is an apartheid wall. No other country that has built a fence around its borders has ever been called an apartheid wall. But for Israel, this is an apartheid wall. And I was very worried to see an Amnesty report, I don't know whether you saw it, came out, I think, a few weeks ago, which said the fact that we use facial identification at the border is apartheid. Now, anybody who's gone through Heathrow Airport or any airport in the world knows you use facial identification. You present your passport, and if your face doesn't look like your face on your passport, you're in trouble. And that's exactly what we were doing. It was not done. It was done only with people who wanted to move from Judea and Samaria or from Gaza into Israel. We did facial identification. Somehow, this is the Amnesty decided this is apartheid. And by the way, we can't ignore it. It's very harmful because people throughout the world, when they hear the word apartheid, will say, oh, well, that we can't touch. And they know what they're doing, opponents of Israel, smearing with apartheid. What else? Civilian casualties. In any war, it's a tragedy, but you cannot conduct military activities against an enemy that puts its forces among civilian population without having some civilian casualties. I remember reading about D-Day, that on the first day of D-Day, 40,000 French civilians were killed. Clearly, there was no interest in doing it. It can be disproportionate. And the Israeli army, I recently attended a conference in Herzliya of advocate generals from different armies, organized by RJAG. And they said Israel takes more precautions to protect against harming civilians than any other army. And by the way, we do it for a number of reasons. We do it for humanitarian reasons, but also from interest. Killing civilians harms Israel. It enabled Hamas to say, look, they're attacking civilians. It doesn't give us any military advantage. Therefore, we take tremendous efforts, again, for humanitarian reasons, for our own reasons, and also from a PR reason to prevent it. Nevertheless, you must have read, civilians were killed. It's a war crime. It ain't a war crime. It's a war crime if you deliberately kill civilians or even negligently. But if you're attacking, we're attacking rockets of Hamas, which are placed next to the civilians, we have the commander on the spot has to weigh, is it proportionate? And clearly there can be cases where, for instance, in when we were fighting in Gaza, the Hamas put a military headquarters under a hospital. We could, under the laws of war, we could have attacked it. We didn't. Because the Israeli army came to the conclusion that the attacking a hospital would be disproportionate, even to the military advantage of taking out the command post. But when a rocket is about to be fired at Israeli civilians, we also have to take into account not only that, but our possible civilian casualties. And clearly, it's awfully important to take out that rocket before it's fired. And these decisions are made by military commanders on the spot under fire. And again, not most armies in the world don't pay attention to this. The Israel army does. Again, for the dual reason, our own humanitarian reasons, our pilots don't want to kill civilians, and the state doesn't want to do it. We're giving a present to the other side. They're just too happy in many cases to show, Israel's killed civilians. What else? Self-determination for Palestinians. Personally, I think the Palestinians are entitled to self-determination. Not everybody will agree with me. But you won't find any reference to the fact that Israel, we're also entitled to self-determination. When you look at all these UN declarations and records and things talking about self-determination for the Palestinians, not a word of the fact that Israel has. And we've established the state. What else? Proportionality in warfare. You must have heard it, Casey. Israel has used disproportionate force against military targets. Anybody who's had any experience of military, of armed conflict, knows you want to use disproportionate. You want to hit the enemy, the enemy's armed forces, harder than they hit you. They should know playing around with you is dangerous. There was once a cartoon in a French magazine which showed an animal in a cage, poor thing in a cage. Underneath it, there was a caption, "Be careful. This animal is dangerous. When attacked, it defends itself." That's sometimes too abysmal. They should know that if they attack us, we will hit back harder, if possible, than they hit against military targets. But every army in the world does that. If you're attacked with a rifle, there's no rule, you can only shoot back with a rifle. You can't use a machine gun. That's not fair. Since I'm speaking to a UK thing, I could say it's not cricket. Well, it ain't cricket. In warfare, you want to hit the enemy. But again and again, we hear accusations Israel is using disproportionate force in warfare. And I think the answer is yes. And it sometimes works. Hezbollah have learnt that when they attack us, we hit them back hard. And they're being careful not to renew it. I hope Hamas also learns the same lesson. One of the problems is the criticism doesn't come from foreign military people. They know the law. They know that you don't, that you use force in them. It comes from people who have no contact with actual military conflict. And here again, my experience with judge advocate generals of military from other countries, they have no problem with it whatsoever. But you do find foreign office people who, luckily, perhaps for some European states, haven't been involved in war, have no contact with armed conflict, and say, "Oh no, you've got to use proportionate. If they only attack you with one cannon, you can't shoot back with two cannons. It's rubbish. We have a problem. We have a real PR problem." One other issue is that somehow it's been invented that there's a right of return for people who fled or expelled from the country and to their descendants. So it's sufficient that your grandfather came from Palestine in 1948. You have a right under international law to return to Israel. There is no such right in international law. No other country says there's a right. Some countries allow. If you're from Irish descent, the island will give you a priority. We give it to people of Jewish people. But it's an internal decision. Germany does the same. But somehow, for Israel, you must have heard this. Or there's a right of return to descendants because your grandfather came. I mean, there's no such thing. But for Israel, it's been invented. And the final thing is topical issue that the UN International Court of Justice can give advisory opinions to United Nations bodies. And they've done it normally on technical issues of international law. But their rule is they will not do it if the real issue is a dispute between two states. And the rationale behind this is that states have to agree to go to an international legal body. They can't be forced to. Therefore, the International Court of Justice in the past has, I think, correctly and wisely said, we won't deal with an issue if the real issue is a dispute between two states. If they wish to, they can ask for us to decide the issue. But we won't give an advisory opinion on this, except for Israel. Here, the International Court of Justice has already decided in a previous case that they can give an opinion because they're giving it to the UN. But of course, then they were addressed by the UN. And furthermore, the UN poses the question. Every other case which is they ask, is something legal? For Israel, the UN General Assembly said, what are the results of Israel's illegal activities? In other words, they're asking in advance. At law school, you're always taught about the famous question the accuser asked, have you stopped beating your wife? Answer, yes or no. Same as, in other words, the court is told it's illegal. Now, just tell us what the consequences are. And the fact that it's really a dispute between Israel and the Palestinians is irrelevant. It would be relevant for every other country. To sum up these issues, Israel respects international law. It's in our interest to respect international law. It's enforced by our courts, but it enforces international law as it really is, not as it's tailor-made for Israel.
Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.